a new device with a battery that lasts 20 months. And our bots just Clippy reincarnated. And finally, a delivery drone that will make Jason blush. All that and a whole lot more on Tech News Today.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today, episode 1489, recorded Monday, April 11th, 2016.
This episode of Tech News Today is brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/TNT and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/TNT.
And by ZipRecruiter. Are you hiring? With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post to 100-plus job sites, including social networks, all with a single click. Screen, rate, and hire the right candidates fast. Try ZipRecruiter with a free 4-day trial now at ZipRecruiter.com/TNT.
Hello, and welcome to Tech News Today. This is the show where we talk about tech news with people who like to make mildly offensive euphemisms about technology.
Sometimes. Not very often, though.
I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Who are you talking about?
Offensive wasn't the right word. Inappropriate. Mildly inappropriate.
I think there's at least one story today that has the risk of treading into those waters.
Well, with our
guests. Possibly more.
Our guests, really any story can tread into those waters, and that's why we love to have him so much.
That's right. Ian Thompson from The Register. How's it going, sir?
It's fine. That was quite an intro. I'm quite sure what people are expecting. I mean, whether you want me to come on and curse like a sailor or moon the camera or something. But no, always a pleasure to be here.
Maybe not always mildly offensive, but you're always going to say something that makes me like I've never heard it before, at the very least. Mm-hmm. You have some phrases that I've never heard before. And I appreciate that about you, Ian. So thank you.
I appreciate it, too. That's what I meant to say.
Always happy to help. My editor says, Ian, a conversation with you can go from 0 to 60 in about 3 seconds.
Well, about right. We should get started then.
Yeah.
The Apple Watch launched nearly a year ago. And even though Apple owns half of the smartwatch market, a new survey out by tech advertising company Fluent says the majority of the 2,578 adults they surveyed say the watch is not a successful product. Well, what does this really mean? On Friday, when I was out sick in bed all day, that was the one day in the past year that I have not worn my watch. I love it, but of course, that's an N of one. I'm just talking about me personally. Many, many languish in top drawers everywhere. What do you guys think? Apple Watch, success or failure?
Ian, you go first.
I've been a skeptic about smartwatches ever since they first came out, and certainly there's nothing in the Apple Watch I've seen that is anything other than for people who are either dedicated Apple fans or, in the case of people buying the 10 grand version, utter posers who need to be slapped down at the first available opportunity.
The top, the first story.
No. I said all Apple fans, Megan, you're fine. No, I mean, seriously, if you're a diehard Apple fan, then I can see the point to them. But quite frankly, unless you can get a SIM card in there and a battery life which lasts more than 24 hours, I really don't see the utility from a technology standpoint. You've still got to have your phone with you. If you try and make phone calls with them, everyone can hear both sides of the conversation with what's going on. I think they're a problem looking for a solution. And no one's actually come up with a significant reason why you should have them yet. I mean, there's the medical health thing and all that sort of thing. But, you know, we could have sensors to do that without paying ridiculous amounts of money for what is essentially just an add-on to your phone.
I feel like some of the kind of extended information from the study kind of reveals why, or at least a big piece of it. They say 77% of Apple Watch owners consider it a success. Two-thirds of those plan to upgrade when the new one comes out. So obviously people that get it more often than not are happy that they have it, right? The Wristly Research Group actually published its own study that shows that owners have a high satisfaction rating of the Apple Watch. So what we're seeing time and time again is, if you've been convinced to get one, and that says a couple of things possibly about you, that you're open to kind of new, you know, cutting edge technology, let's say, that you like Apple products and you're willing to kind of put your money, you know, into Apple products if there is a new one or whatever. It also kind of seems to point to possibly Apple and maybe the wider kind of smart watch market in general missing the mark on marketing. telling those people that aren't convinced why they actually need it. And I think that kind of ties in with what you're saying, Ian, at least for me. Like, I have a smartwatch. I haven't been wearing it lately. I keep forgetting to charge it, and it's not essential. And, you know, part of that is, yes, while it has some nice features, being notified on my wrist is sometimes very convenient versus other things, but there is no killer app. There is no one thing like there is with a smartphone, you know, all the amazing things that a smartphone could do, or there was, let's say, with, I don't know, an iPod, you know, when that kind of blew up. There is no one thing that the smartwatch can do that you have to have one in order to do it. It's still very much an accessory. And not to mention, fashion is very low on the reasons of on the list of reasons to buy one. And I think anything that you're wearing, fashion has to be a consideration. For a lot of people, this just doesn't look good, period.
Yeah, I mean, also the pricing policy, I think, comes back to what you were saying about fashion. You were basically buying the same watch for between, what, $250 and $1,000. And the only difference between them was the strap. Now, that's a really weird pricing model. Now, yeah, if you're sold on Apple's products, I can see you buying them because, you know, it's a nice addition to your iPhone or your iPod if you're slightly older. But, I mean, if you're actually trying to convince people who aren't into Apple to buy one of these, you're right. There's no clear unique selling point. And they are kind of pricey for what they are.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel like all of Apple products sort of fell into this in the beginning. Like, unless you absolutely loved listening to music, the iPod didn't make sense for a lot of people in the beginning before podcasts were popular. I mean, I use my Apple Watch more than I use my iPad. Like, I think sometimes I have to convince myself to use my iPad.
Is that because it's always on you?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely... again, it is a heart rate monitor. That's not something that my, that's not something that my phone does. But yeah, I do think that your description of a problem waiting for a solution or a solution waiting for a problem, I guess, was what you said. I think that is true. But I do feel like, I feel like even the iPhone was sort of that in the very beginning. So I do think this is the beginning and it's going to become, better and more useful in the future.
Yeah, I mean, possibly. I mean, the iPod did solve a fundamental problem, which was up until that point, there had been MP3 players, but they were all uniformly lousy. And I used to have two or three of them, and I know that of which I speak.
Oh, man, some of them were horrible.
I know. I mean, that the big blue one, I forget who it was by, but the user interface was dire. And iPod and Apple got a music player which looked good, easy to use. The original version of iTunes was fantastic. So that all tied in nicely. Similarly with the iPhone. It was a bit of a dog in hardware terms, but the user interface was fantastic. It looked very pretty. And eventually they got the hardware sorted out so that it was comparable with other phones. But with the smartwatch, Megan, is there a particular app that you find yourself using again and again? Or is it just, you have a broad range of solutions on your wrist now?
Well, that's the thing. I think it's selling it as something where you can get all these apps. That was a mistake. And because there's no, I mean, besides the workout and the activity app, there's not an app that I use. It's notifications and it's activity. So yes, there are smartwatches. I mean, maybe this is a good comparison to the iPod, because there are a lot of smartwatches that were doing both of these things before, but this one is prettier and nicer and works, you know, with all my Apple products. So maybe that was the same thing with your MP3 player. Mm-hmm. It didn't necessarily work with iTunes. It wasn't as pretty. It didn't work as well. And then you got the iPod made it, you know, it did the same things as these other MP3 players, but not as good and does it better. So yeah, I think there's not a killer app for it that I love. I mean, there's, I can't even respond to email messages. I guess text messages, I do respond on my wrist to those because it's just quick replies, and that's nice. So that would be the killer app for me.
Okay. Yeah, it just, as I say, I mean, it's a lovely piece of design. The UI is very good, and as Apple UIs generally are. But, you know, it needs something more. It needs something to actually get people to think, I must have this because. And I mean, I've tried out pretty much every Android smartwatch out there, and they're all, the user interface is never great. Some of them are ugly as sin. I mean, the LG one, my wife calls a woman repeller, but...
some of the designs are pretty bad.
Oh, yeah. Dire. That's
you know, huge,
dire.
Chunky, bulky. And I think that's really going to turn a lot of people away is just, you know, for a lot of people, it's convincing them that technology is something that should be worn. And I think for a lot of people, just that thought is of a world that they have never expected to go down. You know what I mean? And that's a big hurdle right out of the gate. So who knows? Maybe this is a good starting point for Apple and for the platform in general. And maybe their second rev is going to blow us away with something new. Who knows? A rounded screen. I don't know. All right. So I know Jeff Bezos, Amazon CEO, tweeted a few weeks back that he would be revealing the newest addition to the Kindle lineup. Well, last week. But you snooze and you lose. That didn't happen. In this case, you snooze and a Chinese e-commerce site accidentally leaks your product for you on its product page ahead of schedule. It's now taken down, of course, but apparently it'll be called the Kindle Oasis, and Amazon has changed the design from previous iterations. The Oasis has a large bezel on one side, of course, depending on how you're holding it, right or left side. It's ideal for holding the device one-handed without blocking the screen. There are page turn buttons built into the front of that bezel too. It'll have a 300 pixel per inch screen, same as the Kindle Voyage, along with 60% more LEDs inside for improved backlight performance, supposedly 20% lighter than previous models. And here's the big differentiator, a rechargeable battery case for the device that allows for 20 months of standby time on full charge. 20 months. This is crazy.
But still not as long as my books. I have a hardcover.
But dang close. I mean, really, 20 months, you've lost interest in your book after 20 months. So.
Who are they marketing this at? Is it people who are lost on a desert island with those power chargers who desperately need something to read for the 20 months it takes for them to be picked up and rescued? It does seem like an insanely long period of time to have as a battery life. You think, I mean, we're always complaining about battery life in our products. You know, the smartphone, you can recharge every day or so, smartwatch every day. But 20 months? Surely they could have saved some of the battery from there, cut down the weight even more, and put more features in there. It defies belief.
Well, so it's just to clarify, it's 20 months if you've got the battery case as well as the Kindle. So the Kindle has its own battery. The battery case has extra battery. If you've got them plugged in together, or if you've got them kind of connected and you aren't plugged into charge capability, to power in the wall or whatever, it's going to use the case battery before it uses the Kindle battery. I will always take more battery. If they're willing to throw more battery in there, hallelujah, because that's what I'm always asking for. I think as far as portable devices are concerned, that's one of my number one complaints, is that battery never lasts as long as it should. And with Kindle, obviously it's different technology that's happening here. You're not running an LCD screen. All of this overhead is taken away because of kind of the e-ink screen technology and everything. So it allows for a longer battery life. I just wish we could see this in so many other things.
Mm-hmm. But do we think this is for real? Like, it was on the Japanese
Kindle,
Amazon.
Yeah, KindleOasis.com is owned by Amazon, apparently. So one could assume, who knows, maybe they've bought up Kindle, insert word here, across the board just to protect themselves. But that's about as much as we have to go on, as well as kind of confirming a lot of things that people were expecting out of it. One thing that's missing, which is strange because it would be called the Oasis if this is true, is it's missing any sort of water resistance or water protection, which is a highly requested feature for Kindles because, people take their books to the beach. They want to take their Kindle to the beach or poolside or whatever and know that it'll be protected.
So. Yeah, I mean, my wife uses hers in the bath for just, and it's just...
There you go.
It's a very old Kindle, so it doesn't matter if she drops it that much, but she would be terribly hurt if she did. Amazon have made a very good business out of doing these long-lasting ebook readers in a way that a lot of people, have had problems with in the past. So it does look like a very interesting product. As I say, I think the Chinese distributor might be getting a couple of angry phone calls, but if it is all legit, it's surprisingly common how these things leak out just with third-party suppliers getting the date slightly wrong.
Yep.
Right. So it was on the official Chinese Amazon site, but then got taken down.
It was a third party e-commerce site. What was the name of it? I forgot to write that down. But yes, it was not. I can tell you for sure, it was not the official Amazon site. It was Tmall.
But it's supposed to come out next week, so we'll know.
Yeah, well, which is weird because Bezos actually went to Twitter a couple of weeks ago and said, next week, big Kindle news coming. And wow, I guess you shouldn't say things like that if you don't actually know, because here we are a couple of weeks later. Mm-hmm. So. Whatever.
Well, bad news for all of those 2,700 Tesla Model X owners of vehicles manufactured before March 26th, 2016, the company has issued a recall. There's an issue with the locking hinge that lets the third row of seats fold forward. The company warns that the hinge could fail in an accident. They will replace the seats, but they don't have anyone, but they say don't have anyone sit back there until you have it replaced, or at least don't let anyone sit back there that you like.
I wouldn't sit back
That's
there.
That's interesting take on that, Megan. Yeah. You drive out, you chauffeur around a few people who you might like to slip into the back seat
right.
sometime.
Sit in the back seat of my right. Tesla.
Oh, the sudden there's a hedgehog in the road. Screech! But it's unfortunate. It does seem like the Model X is suffering some real teething problems. I mean, we had the problems with the doors about a year ago, then another set of problems there. And it's any version 1.1 of a product is going to be tricky. But having this many things coming up, I think it is starting to make people think, well, you know, is this the one lemon that he's put out, you know, of late? It's a very advanced car. It's very futuristic, but it does seem to be having a run of bad luck. I mean, the launch event was a disaster. They do have these recurring mechanical problems, and admittingly, they're fixing them free of charge, which does, you know, placate people up to a point. But it's a very expensive car to be having so many things going wrong with it.
Yeah, it is a manufacturing defect. It's not part of the design, and actually, it's not their part either. It was a third party that sourced the piece essentially that's gone wrong here. It's manufactured by an outside supplier. So Tesla isn't even going to incur the cost of the replacement. The third party supplier is going to do that. So there you go. Most of the affected vehicles are in customers' hands. So it just takes like a 2 hour, you know, you bring it in for a service, 2 hour visit, and it'll be all fixed for you and everything. But
yeah, but those people have been waiting a long time, and then they're going to have to send it back. That's a bummer. But good for Tesla. I mean, nothing has happened. There haven't been any incidents.
Yeah. Good that nothing has happened yet.
No fatalities. But you do have to wonder, really, with the Tesla 3, what we're going to find out about these when they start rolling off the production line, because they're going to have to produce them very fast. They're going to have to. It's a completely new design again. So it does make me wonder what kind of teething problems we're going to see coming out. It's kind of odd because the Tesla S, we've had no massive problems with in the past.
Mm-hmm.
They've done a couple of upgrades, but nothing sort of major that you'd see. So I think all eyes now on the 3, and we shall see how that develops.
Yeah, Tesla's never had the demand quite like they've had with the 3. They have a lot to turn around in a reasonable amount of time, I suppose, but probably more to turn around than they even expected. And speaking of electric car buyers in the U.S. have a nice incentive to buy an EV, a $7,500 tax credit. This is not a refund. It's not a deduction of the purchase cost. It's important to note. But getting that full credit does come with some asterisks involved. It applies to any vehicle with a battery larger than 5 kilowatt hour. And so basically it's like you get $417 worth of credit at 5 kilowatt hours, additional $417 for each kilowatt hour beyond that. And some plug-in hybrids are actually also eligible. But kind of the trick here is that automakers have a limited number of these that they can actually give out before it starts to kind of peel back and expire. 200,000 full tax credits to award. Once that's reached, the credit cuts in half for two more quarters, and then it cuts in another half for two more quarters. And at that point, it's kind of canceled entirely. So to kind of put that into perspective, Tesla Model 3, as we were just talking about, has over 300,000 pre-orders right now. Some of those early pre-orders are probably eligible for the full credit. Some of them will get half and some are not going to get any. So right there, bam, wiped out.
Yeah, I mean, when you're talking about taxes, it's, you know, it's like we make ourselves feel better, but it's really just off of your taxes. It's a long time before you see that money.
It'd be so much better if you just kind of got that money.
Yes.
Or you could take it off the purchase mm-hmm. price, but it is what it is. I'll take whatever I can get. What do you think, Ian?
Yeah, I mean, tax incentives are a very good way to get new technology started, and the electric car tax incentive is a very good system indeed. But as you say, they've now, I think the last figures I saw was 331,000 Tesla 3s being booked in, so
wow.
Nearly half of those aren't going to get the full tax credit that they're expecting. And it all depends, I think, on when they take delivery of the vehicle itself and pay the final amount. Honestly, anything to get more electric cars on the road and more charging stations built up is fine, because, you know, the idea that in the 21st century we're still burning an immensely valuable a thing like hydrocarbons just to get power to put our foot down and go around corners fairly fast is frankly laughable. You know, the very first electric cars appeared around about the same time as the first petrol cars. But they just didn't have as good a source of electricity or a source of energy. So it's been a long time coming. And I don't know, we're pretty good up in the Bay Area. But if you go down to sort of Shanghai or Beijing, they desperately need electronic cars because air pollution levels are so dire. And that's a problem which we're seeing repeated around the world.
No kidding.
Yeah, and as long as we're talking about Tesla again, a lot of people in the chat room are pointing out that many cars get recalls. Absolutely, I get a recall for my Toyota minivan all the time. And, of course, reason why we're talking about Tesla is because, well, personally speaking, I won't speak for you, but I am jealous. I would like a Tesla, and I can't have one, so I will make fun of them. And the end.
Yes, I too would dearly love a Tesla, but really can't justify the cost at the moment. It's also, buying any new car, you lose about a third of the value when you drive it off the lot. Although I think with Teslas, their value is holding up fairly well. So, yeah, it could be interesting. And, yes, everyone has product recalls. And also we saw with the rash of stories about Teslas going on fire. It's like, I think they've had, three or four of them now? And when you think how many petrol and diesel cars go up in smoke on American roads every year, then it's a flea-bite in comparison. But, yeah, quite frankly, I think a lot of us want a Tesla, and so this is why these kind of stories run.
All right. Well, you were talking about clean technology, and makers of the clean tech CTS 1000 claimed that their server used 80% less energy than other servers. But apparently, Ian, this was all a big scam. Tell us what happened.
This was a really interesting case. It was a company who was presumably seeking to cash in on the green tech revolution. And they were touting a server which they said would save you 80% of power and storage costs in your standard data center. And they released this sales material comparing it to what they called similar servers from HP, IBM, and various other manufacturers. They forgot to mention a couple of things. It was a 32-bit server running the 64-bit server, so very little use in an advanced data center. And one of the guys who was bringing in investors, a guy called Ken Paxton, who's now the Attorney General of Texas, brought in about $840,000 in investors' cash and didn't tell the potential investors that he was getting money for bringing in these shareholders. So he now has the SEC after him, and the SEC is also going after the CEO. One of the board directors who was in on the scam has actually handed back the money and the shares and appears to be getting off with a slap on the wrist. So, interesting times for the Texas Attorney General. It's going to be interesting if you're the top lawmaker of a state, how you can then swing, well, I didn't really know that I was doing anything wrong, so there's no really need to prosecute me, is there? So, a rather skeezy little affair, but the company's still going. I gave them a call today to try and get a statement and got an answer phone, but they're now repositioning themselves as a data security company. So a bit of pivoting going on there to get rid of the bad name, I think.
But not as, I don't know if I'd trust them with my information at this point.
No. I mean, it's, okay, strictly a personal view, not the registers, but any company that gets involved with this kind of thing, you've got to treat them with a sort of fairly long barge pole and check them out very, very carefully before you get involved. It's under new management now. It's, you know, the company has paid $200,000 to the SEC to make the complaint go away. But I think there is such a choice of hardware vendors out there that you really shouldn't need to risk something like this unless the benefits are there. And in this case, it doesn't seem like they were.
And finally, in the world of consumer camera technology, who could forget Lytro's efforts from a few years back? In 2012, we saw the company's first generation of pocket-sized cameras. They could do something very different using light field technology, which basically allows a person to take a picture, to go in after the fact, and use Lytro's software to kind of refocus the image. After the fact, the camera captured the light field as the intensity of light in an image, as well as the direction of those light rays in space. Super kind of sci-fi stuff and very interesting technology. It seemed a little gimmicky in consumer hands, I would say, and they kind of put it into some phones and all that kind of stuff. Neat, but not necessarily essential in its early form. So what did Lytro do then? Well, they turned to Hollywood. Today, Lytro announced the Lytro Cinema. It's a camera targeted at TV and film professionals. It captures 755 raw megapixel 40K resolution at 300 frames per second. And that adds up to 400 gigs of data every second of footage, which is crazy. By taking its tech to the cinema world, it enables filmmakers to, they say, eliminate the green screen for good. And this is really interesting. So it's called depth screen. Essentially, what it means is they're analyzing the shot with every frame, right? If you're in this mode specifically, it makes objects at certain depths of the footage transparent, essentially. So you can say beyond this point, you know, of depth, everything behind that should be transparent. So you don't necessarily need a green screen behind you to key out. It's literally eliminating the stuff that is behind you.
Wow.
Which is just kind of blows my mind. They also have a high bandwidth mode that allows for you to like reconstruct things like shutter, frame rate, all that kind of stuff. You can use motion blur as a tool and it's not baked in, so you can kind of you can enact your own actual motion blur based on all the information that they gather with every single frame. Really cool application of this technology. I've always wondered kind of what Lytro leads to, because I thought it was neat, but I didn't feel like I needed it in my phone. You know, like refocusing after the fact just seemed like power that I didn't necessarily need in my picture taking abilities, but it was cool nonetheless. This seems perfect. Like, this actually makes a lot of sense to me. What do you guys think?
Well, it does, but it's also incredibly expensive.
It is. I mean,
we're talking, what, $125,000 just to rent it?
Yeah.
I mean, can you imagine being the stagehand who spills the producer's coffee over the thing and, you know, is then being hung, drawn, and quartered by the accounts department?
You'll never work in this town again!
Quite literally, yes. You know, it's difficult to do that with broken fingers, but yeah. No, I mean, it's an amazing piece of technology, and if it works even half as well as the company is saying, then it's going to be really good. The problem is you've then got to get a generation of Hollywood and other sort of filmmakers to actually learn how to use it to its best degree. So I've got a nasty feeling we might be seeing some horrible special effects with the first couple of iterations.
Right.
But once people actually learn how to do it, learn how to hack around within its systems, then I think we could be seeing something really rather special. But it does come with a really, really hefty price tag.
That it does.
I think we could put you right in between us and we could just get rid of the TV and everything and it would just seem like you were right here.
Huh?
Yeah. I think that would be worth it.
Here, you would have to get a very expensive camera into the register offices and I couldn't guarantee its safety. Okay. Some of the things go down here, but no.
It's expensive and we'd be renting it for $125,000. Yes. They claim that it's the highest resolution video sensor. So, I mean, there's that. I mean, in the Hollywood pursuit of bigger, better, faster, all this kind of stuff, maybe this, you know, that has this going for it. So,
but we're not getting this in our phones anytime soon.
Well, I don't know. Lytro, I don't know. That's a good, I mean, not this, not Lytro Cinema, probably. But I do wonder if Lytro's kind of given up on the kind of portable consumer facing aspect of what they're doing. Probably not in the long term, but it really seems like they've figured, because they also actually introduced at the end of last year something called Emerge, which is like cinematic VR, using Lytro for like VR purposes for cinema as well. So it seems like they've realized, or they're kind of realizing that maybe Hollywood and you know, big budget filmmaking is the way for them to make a lot of money. And I guess time will tell as far as that's concerned. But. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it'll bring in a certain amount of cash, but as the technology advances, we get better processors, more storage, faster, you know, faster run times. I can see this being consumer phones within 5-10 years without, you know, it's something. If you can teach consumers how to use it and they get to love it, that could be a real killer selling point for a phone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, after the break, we have got lots and lots of bots. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, a bot that can help you invest. It's called Wealthfront, and it's not just a bot. You can work with a real person, too. You know you need to invest your money, but unless you have a background in finance, it often feels like you're doing it all wrong. And even if you do have a background in finance, maybe you'd rather be doing something else with your free time. You should try Wealthfront. Traditional advisors charge huge fees, between 1% and 3% of what they manage. With Wealthfront, you pay 0.25% a year. That's 25 basis points, 0 commissions, and no hidden fees. So that's less than $5 a month to invest a $30,000 account. There are no additional charges for any of Wealthfront's services. With Wealthfront's new portfolio review, you can see if your portfolio is at risk. You can find out how diversified your investments are, what you're losing to fees. You can even minimize your taxes. You can get started investing today with as little as $500. It only takes a few minutes to sign up at Wealthfront.com, and it goes right to work. Starts monitoring your portfolio around the clock and taking action as soon as an opportunity arises. Wealthfront is transparent and accessible. You can view and track all your accounts in one place. And now Wealthfront can track both your Wealthfront and your non-Wealthfront bank and brokerage accounts that they will provide in a summary of all of your assets. You can also see every trade that Wealthfront makes on your behalf in your dashboard, on your desktop or with their mobile app. Wealthfront's process is based on Nobel Prize-winning academic research and the best investment practices out there. Now, we've heard from a lot of you that have used Wealthfront, and you love how they can diversify, how you can diversify your portfolio. You can buy stocks from in-demand companies, like a lot of the companies that we talk about, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, all commission-free. Wealthfront manages over $2.6 billion in client assets, and it's growing rapidly every day. So what are you waiting for? Invest in your future today with Wealthfront. Visit wealthfront.com/TNT to sign up and get your free personalized investment portfolio. You'll see the customized allocation they recommend for your profile. And just for Twit listeners, if you sign up to invest, Wealthfront will manage your first $15,000 entirely free of charge. And that's for life. Join the many Twit fans who have seen huge success with Wealthfront and claim your offer today at wealthfront.com/TNT.
All right. Let's talk about lots of different kinds of bots. In today's segment, lots of bots. I didn't know if it was kind of Italian. Lots of bots.
I like it.
First, tomorrow morning, Facebook's F8 developer conference kicks off with a number of expected bot announcements. Leo Laporte, Gina Trapani, and I will actually be here on set at 10 a.m. Pacific, live streaming coverage of the event. So check in for that tomorrow. That's twit.tv/live. But I'm sure we're going to see a number of new bot projects revealed on stage during the event, and keeping track of all that bot action can be difficult, overwhelming, time-consuming, all that stuff. What we need is an app store for bots, and the folks at Botlist are heeding your call, if you did, in fact, call for that. Botlist launched today, perfect timing for tomorrow's event, and it's a third-party database that follows bots across all platforms, or many platforms anyways, SMS, Slack, all types of mobile apps, and yes, Facebook Messenger as well. Just kind of like a centralized directory of all things bots. There's 400 bots listed currently. They're manually reviewed before they're included. So there's, you know, they're kind of combing over those. And yeah, a place to find all your bots. all your bots bits. What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, it does seem that bots are very much the sort of the fashion du jour at the moment. Mm-hmm. We had this at Build at Microsoft. And now we're getting this from Facebook. What we're expecting is from Facebook to bring out a series of development tools to build your own bots and insert those into the site. I think a third-party sort of bot store like this is a good idea, but it's very much going against the flow of the market. Far too many companies really like are following Apple's example when it comes to selling hardware and software, and they want everyone within their little walled gardens. Windows has done the same. So whether or not there's whether they're going to allow a third-party bot store in there, that could be quite interesting. I'm just slightly skeptical in this whole push to bots move as it goes on. I mean, okay, I'm a little bit older than you guys, but I was mentally scarred by Clippy as a youngster, and you know, I don't think I've ever really recovered from that. And I really can't see the problem of it. I can't see the point of an awful lot of these bots. I mean, they're cute, but you really wouldn't want to try and do anything serious with them.
Yeah. Clippy was cute too. And we all know what happened when Clippy came along.
Yeah. Well, I was at the press conference when they announced that Clippy was going to be turned off by default. And you've never seen the level of enthusiasm that, you know, British journalists, usually reserved, quiet types, and we make it a point never, ever to applaud at a press conference, jumping up, punching the air, shouting woo-hoo. And it was just like, it's over. They killed it at last.
Well, I think the bots now are much less pushy. They don't try to contact you until you contact them. They don't, you know, pop up or anything. You know, I've used like Assist Bot in Telegram, and I've used it in text messaging. And, you know, you have to ask it a question. You initiate the conversation, and then it just comes back with things that are, you know, sometimes helpful, sometimes not. I haven't had a lot of success. But bots, more than anything, seem to make it really obvious that everyone wants, like you're saying, everyone wants people to stay in their platform. You know, create bots so that you stay in Facebook Messenger or you stay in Slack. You know, everyone just wants to keep you for as long as possible. And it seems like it's the golden age of bots because there's no advertising, but that's coming.
I think the interesting thing about all of this bot stuff is just basically why they are kind of such a hot button topic right now. And that's that, like, apps, I don't know, it's kind of an unruly world with apps. I play with a lot of them. It's harder to find good apps. Discovery is difficult. how many apps, you know, people are installing on their devices regularly. Like I install a lot of apps regularly on my devices because I have to, because it's part of what I do. But I think the average person has really slowed down and probably has the apps that they're going to use already installed. And of the apps that are on their device, they're not even using most of those very much, if at all. Bots are just kind of in the platform, like you said, that you're already in. And you know, they're called upon kind of on demand, as opposed to having to go through all of these other, you know, hurdles, jumping over all these hurdles to kind of install them and make a permanent place for them on your device, that sort of stuff. So it's interesting to see, like, they kind of accomplish the same things, but in a much different way. I'll be very curious to see what the kind of longer term, if bots really do replace apps as kind of the next frontier for mobile, let's say.
So what was Microsoft's bot strategy that they talked about at Build, Ian?
And basically, it was bots everywhere all the time. It's this year's thing. They want to tie them into machine learning and so-called AI systems. And it's a way to try and improve the customer experience online, which generally means we're about to muck things up in a big way and then sort of say that you just don't understand it. We've seen this with Cortana and Siri to an extent, but I think in general, it's another way of breaking down application development into yet another silo. And I'm deeply skeptical. I've got a feeling that this is going to not provide a clear benefit for anyone other than the companies involved, which always makes me very nervous when tech companies try that, because it usually ends in disaster.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so there's bots for customer service in an app, but what about real-life robots who can help us in stores? Are you ready for that? The Next Web says Hitachi has released a new robot called the EMIEW3, unless you call it the EMU3, to help in stores. Now, it's been around, I guess, since 2007, but now they've perfected it, added some AI. You know, we've seen Pepper, SoftBank's robot. This one is similar, but better somehow, and child size. Now, do either of you have any idea why it would be child size? Because it's less threatening? I don't know.
Yeah, you could step on it if you need to.
Yeah, I think it's cheaper to manufacture. And doesn't make people frightened. I mean, there's a considerable body of psychological research that says you shouldn't make humanoid robots human size because it really freaks people out. Certainly when the 6-foot Atlas robots started to be used, we had a lot of readers who were just like, this looks like it should be about to kill Sarah Connor. So this is cute. It's red and white. It's child size. Probably couldn't punch you back if you kicked it over. So, you know, I mean, it's nice. It's non-threatening. I'm a little bit skeptical as to how quickly we're going to see them in real world deployments. And it looks like it could handle stairs about the way it's the same way Concorde flies on you on an elastic band. But, you know, it's cute. I think, and this is the problem, when it comes to robot stage, we're acute at the moment. Cute and mildly functional.
Right, because, I mean, I don't know what a customer service robot's going to help me find. Like, what I want to, I don't know why an app can't just help me, like, when I'm in Target, like, find where the peanuts are or something like that. I mean, it seems like that could be in a phone much cheaper and more easily. I know there's beacons. We've, you know, talked about that in stores. But, I mean, is a robot going to recommend a book if I'm in a bookstore? I don't know what it's going
to
do.
A robot might take you where you need to go.
Right, maybe. But I want, like, couldn't an app do that? Like,
I suppose so. Yeah, sometimes, like, I've tried that, and sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't work out.
So you really want to follow something.
Well, I mean, I'm not saying that I want to follow this robot, although I would love the opportunity
you
to
would follow
this
it
robot.
Anywhere.
I would follow this robot through a store. Sure, I'd do that.
But if you do ask for where something is, if you ask for where something is in a store, then store personnel are told to take you to that item.
Right.
And then stand there while you pick it up, because it's a much higher chance that you'll buy it. So that maybe isn't a use for this robot. The robot sort of stands there and is like, is there anything else I can help you with? Isn't that blue one pretty? That sort of thing. Trying to encourage people to buy that way.
Yeah, that's what I want. I want a recommendation engine in my customer service robot. I really think the blue would look good on you. I think you should get that blouse. Something like that. That's what we need.
Okay.
And finally, I just really don't know how to handle this last one. Is it cool that a giant flying robot balloon can maneuver in the air autonomously thanks to its ring of propellers and GPS, and it can find objects that it needs to deliver, in this case, your drink in a bottle, and it swoops down to said object and picks it up? Yes, that's cool. It's how it picks up that bottle that's I don't know, it's kind of hard to watch for some reason. It quite literally lowers itself down onto the object and slides it into its receptacle, kind of like pushing an Audi belly button inward. And then when it flies over to you, it expels the bottle directly into your hand. And by the way, this is what audio listeners get when they ask us to describe what we see in video. So you asked for it, everyone. Now, I'm not sure how widespread the Festo delivery drone will be. I'm not sure I want to ever meet one either. This is one robot I don't think I ever need to meet.
I think if it met like the Hyperloop, that would be awesome. Like if that could deliver people, it could suck me up into its balloon and deliver me somewhere. That would be wonderful.
This is so weird.
I have to say, I watched that and was just like paging Dr. Freud. Dr. Freud, courtesy phone, please. It's rather unnerving and sort of was a cross between something deeply pervy and something out of the Aliens films. The only thing I would say, after having watched the video a couple of times, that thing looks like it would last about 5 seconds outside a very large building. I mean, if you actually took it outside, you know, large blimps are a really good idea in a lot of circumstances, but they don't deal with wind well. And particularly in this country, they don't deal with people with pellet guns well. So I think if they actually did try and use that outside, it would either get shot down or get blown into the side of a building and deflate rapidly.
And if you're using that inside, you need a lot of space. That thing's big.
Yeah.
It's huge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it has to be to provide the lift.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's like, oh, great. It can hand me a bottle of water. It's like, well, guess what? I've got legs, two hands, pretty much sure I've got that one sorted myself, thanks. I mean, look at that. I'm sorry. It's
weird.
We should thank Tech Insider, which is basically filled with stories like this every day. And it's just why I love it so much.
There's something neat about it when it's flying. It's just, I don't like how it picks up bottles and gives them to you. I don't like that.
Weird that the two men on this show are more freaked out about this than Megan is. I mean, it's just like, I'm wondering whether this is some kind of male psychological thing, which is just like tapping into the reptile brainstem of
I don't know. Maybe it's because I've given birth to three children, two at once. I don't know. Who knows? I'll always play that card when given the opportunity.
Yeah, well, you've trumped us on that one.
No comment.
I'm sure neither Jason nor myself have given birth to children and have no intention of doing so.
We have an email.
All right. Gary, thank you for writing, Gary. And saving Ian and Jason from whatever they're experiencing right now. Gary writes regarding our discussion of people slowing their personal Facebook postings. He says, I wondered if you had considered that a leading factor in the Facebook news feed falling in original posts being shared is that Facebook has been actively encouraging video sharing. I have personally found myself much less inclined to spend my limited spare time looking at Facebook for my news feed when the predominant news is cat videos and factual tidbits in video format. If my friends are not sharing original content, I am also less likely to share my original content to contribute to the news feed. I would estimate that my time spent looking at Facebook in the evening before I switch the lights out has been reduced from daily 10 minutes plus to once or twice a week because I'm almost certain to have videos to sift through before I even see an interesting post shared by a friend. Thank you, Gary, for writing. I wish that my Facebook perusing was limited to that because I feel like I spend a lot of time. But I do agree that there are a lot of cat videos. But if you don't look at them, I think that Facebook shows them to you less.
Yeah, but so how do you not look at them? You've already looked at them.
Well, you just, if you scroll through, like Facebook knows if you stop, knows if you play, knows
know,
if you turn
crazy.
The sound
it's
on.
It's really smart.
It knows all those things.
Yes. So if you're susceptible to cat videos, maybe what it is you're trying to wean yourself off the cat videos and you just can't help it because there it is in your feed and you have to watch. Don't do that. But no, I would agree. Like, yes, definitely since video has come along, I feel like more of the feed is about randomness, and I doubt that a lot of those cat videos and those meme videos and everything were ever uploaded by any of your friends. They were reshared and reshared and reshared from some initial company, let's say, that is, you know, that is making money off the fact that they're putting their videos on Facebook and they have a vested interest to do that. And that's, I think, the kind of the bigger problem is that Facebook has gone in some ways from being this hyper personal kind of sharing, you know, what we're all up to sharing, but also news and also memes. And it kind of dilutes what a lot of people maybe got into Facebook in the first place, and it makes it harder to find that kind of stuff. And that lowers your engagement. I know I feel the same way. Totally.
Yeah. I mean, this has been a persistent problem with Facebook's algorithm, and it's one of the things that you will never get a Facebook exec to give you a straight answer to as to why it automatically defaults to top stories rather than newest posts, which newest posts, if you wanted a pure feed from all your friends, incredibly difficult to get. In fact, in some cases, impossible to get. So I think you're right, Jason. I think it's clustering around what it thinks you want to see, which is both stupid from an engagement point of view, but also kind of dangerous because you get people who only converse with people who think the way they do, and that reinforces behavior. And before you know it, you're voting for, I'm not going to mention the person's name, but, sort of comb over and you'll know who I'm talking about. But sorry, I'm sure it's perfectly, it's the best hair everywhere in the world. and Twitter is talking about doing the same thing, and I think it's incredibly dangerous. Some of us just want a raw news feed that they can pull stuff out of, and it's a little bit unhealthy, I think, to go down this route of just showing people what you think they want to see.
Yeah, I've never used Facebook for news.
A lot of people do.
Yeah, I guess so. But yeah, it's never been what I've used it for. But I mean, do you find in your feed that people are sharing fewer personal things?
Yeah. We get a fair amount of stuff. I mean, it's as a journalist, then a couple of years ago, I mean, Google News for some sites was contributing half their traffic, which meant that if a story appeared on Google News, they had to write something about it in order to get those hits. But I mean, that's increasingly less so these days. Facebook is teaming up with media organizations to push certain stories. I think that's going to turn around and bite the media companies that get into bed with it very hard on the backside. I think it's much better just to get a raw feed and let people find stuff that they like, but that makes it harder to sell advertising around it. So, it's commercial pressures versus what people want, really.
Sure. In the end, it's all about money. Coming up, you think you're sending a smiley, but depending on the platform, it's being seen as something completely different. But first, let's take a minute to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that is ZipRecruiter. If you're hiring, if you need to know where to post your job, find the best candidates, wherever they happen to be, it's difficult. Posting jobs in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. It turns out the internet is a huge, huge place. Putting all your eggs in one basket can lead to you hiring a chicken instead of a beast. But you know how it is. Submitting your job to all of those baskets is incredibly time-consuming. It's important. After all, how are you going to find that beast for that coveted position? But you don't have the time to submit to all those awesome places. If you're also running the other facets of your business, managing your own team of beasts, all of that. So if you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites in one swoop. And now you can with ZipRecruiter.com. You can post to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Make it super easy for you. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. You just post once and watch your candidate just kind of roll into the ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. There's no juggling emails, no calls to your office. You can also do things like quickly screen your candidates. You can rate them, hire the right person fast. They make the whole process super easy. You'll find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. ZipRecruiter will make you beastly. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. Check it out for yourself. That's ZipRecruiter.com/TNT. And we thank ZipRecruiter for their support of Tech News Today. All right, TNT's fan of the day is Kimberly Lightning Martin, who posted this picture on Facebook holding a video episode of TNT nicely in that tiny rectangular box that comprises the Apple Watch. Of course, the orientation of the video kind of means that she would have to like hold her hand out like she was punching someone in order to watch it. And that could get tiring, if not a little violent. So I don't know how that works for you. But hey, whatever works, I suppose. Kimberly, we will not judge. Show us how you watch or listen to TNT. Just record a video or take a picture of yourself or your setup. Post it on Instagram, Google+, Twitter, or Facebook and use the hashtag #HowIWatchTNT and we'll find it.
That's the killer app, apparently, for the Apple Watch.
Yes.
The
one that lets you'll watch your videos like this.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I do admire her dedication to using her smartwatch on that front. But, Really, I mean, that's kind of eye strain level. You're much better, really. Watch it on your phone, watch it on your monitor. This is what we do. You know,
My hunch is that that was a screenshot. Prove you can do it sort of thing. Yeah. See, I can do it.
Yeah.
I don't do it, but I can.
It could have just been a screenshot.
Yeah,
well.
It could have been a screenshot. Mm-hmm. You know.
Either that or someone's walking around like that, can't quite twist it.
I guess at that point, maybe do the whole on your wrist thing. You know how some people wear their watch like mm-hmm. right here?
All right, well, speaking of miscommunication and symbols and signs, emoji were supposed to allow us to bridge the language gap, but it appears to make everything so much more confusing, especially if you're on different platforms. The Verge pointed us to a recent study from the University of Minnesota attempting to prove the significant potential for miscommunication, both for individual emoji renderings and for different emoji renderings across platforms. So, for example, the grimace emoji gets misinterpreted in all kinds of different ways.
That's the grimace
that's
emoji
the grimace.
Right there.
Some people think it's positive. Some people think it's negative.
Yeah, because sometimes, I can see the confusion. That doesn't seem to be distinctly one or the other. It's kind of like, it's not tilted up like a smile would be, but it could be kind of like a or something. And like,
yeah, I feel like when I get a grimace emoji, I know exactly what it means.
Really? But you see it as from other people on your same platform, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I don't ever speak to anyone besides you on any other platform.
Yeah, I know. I'm your only Android friend. I understand. Well, me and Ian.
Yeah, you and Ian are the only people I'd ever communicate with on Android. either on the same platform or different platforms. I mean, the Google grimace emoji is a smile with closed eyes.
They're all pretty smiley except for the Apple one. And the Apple one scores pretty well. It scores in the negative versus the positive of Microsoft, Samsung, LG, and Google. I said it on All About Android. I'll say it here. There is such a thing as the emoji divide.
Mm-hmm.
It does exist. It is real. And we need to get ahead of this before it spirals out of control.
Right. I mean, before you didn't get, I don't know, now you have the middle finger emoji. But for months, I was sending you the middle finger, and you would come to work smiling, and you know, like, I wasn't angry with you.
I was like, you were telling me there was one of something. What were you telling me there was one of? I don't get it.
Yeah, and that's why I use Bitmoji, which is just tells everything. Like, there's my Bitmoji, and that cannot be misinterpreted.
That's true.
Because it looks like me and things I would say.
Oh, hell no. Okay. Do you use these?
I do use them.
Okay. I'm not judging. I've never seen them.
Maybe I started using them when you were on vacation, actually. The Bitmoji phase did go when you come into popularity when you were on vacation. And actually, Anthony tells me Bitmojis are over. And so,
I missed the Bitmoji boat.
Mm-hmm.
Were you on that boat, Ian?
No, I'm standing on the dock waving that boat off and readying the torpedoes to sink it. I think emojis are a bloody awful idea, and I wish they'd never even been created. I'm aware this isn't a popular opinion, but I use these things called words. They're really good for explaining what you mean, and, you know, it's like occasionally I'll do the smiley face on its side symbol because I'm old-fashioned.
But yeah, me too.
I gather emojis are this year's thing, and they're going to be around for an awful lot of time longer, but the sheer variance of expressions across the different platforms does make me wonder, you know, it's the potential for miscommunication is huge. I remember when email first started becoming popular and a lot of people got terribly offended because irony and sarcasm do not come over in email unless you put a symbol in there.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to be really, really careful. And I think with emojis, as I say, the potential for things going wrong, I see people use them. I see somebody actually picked up somebody else on Tinder using just emojis. I still have no idea how that was done, but it must be a generational thing.
If it can be done, it's been done with emojis at some point. It's a big internet.
I think
we just live in it.
I think emoji are over, really, for me. Like, I'm not, I'm kidding. I mean, I need GIFs, sometimes I need GIFs, and Bitmoji, it just needs more. And because I tend to feel like I'm always afraid people are upset at me, so like when they send a GIF or a GIF, or a Bitmoji, or something like
a meme photo, perhaps.
Yeah, like that. then
perfectly acceptable.
It just lightens the mood, and I like that. So I don't know.
What about an emoji appearing for the recipient in the same form as seen by the person sending it? So if I'm sending an emoji, like my version of the emoji is sent to you, I realize there's probably a technical difficulty there versus having just platform emojis and it translates over automatically. It's probably actually a really bad idea. But in the case of this, maybe that would alleviate some of the confusion.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Actually, I think that's a really good idea and it shouldn't be too hard to implement. All you need to have is code libraries for the various different platforms emojis. And you it should automatically translate the emoji that you've been sent into one that fits your formatting. I think that's a great idea. It'll clear up an awful lot of this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's take this to Congress.
Yeah.
Let's make this happen.
Congress, make this happen. Yeah. Good luck.
I retract that last statement.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for joining us. And, you know, I wish I had had an emoji when I said you were offensive earlier, because that's what I meant. I meant your offensive emoji.
You would have used the emoji that went... Yeah. Something like that.
Exactly.
I take it in the spirit with which it was given, Megan.
Ian is, of course, at the Register. Is there anything that you've posted that we haven't talked about?
There's an interesting press conference coming up tomorrow, which sadly I'm going to be at F8. But Stephen Hawking and a Russian billionaire are announcing the Starshot initiative. That could be rather fun. And we'll be covering it here in the office. But other than that, it's going to be F8 Developers Conference for the next 2 days. And after that, maybe finding a shotgun, putting it in my mouth, and just wishing for the sweet release of death.
What a way to end the show.
Sorry, on a high note, Howard.
thank you, Ian, for everything, including that wonderful vision. Always a pleasure getting you on the show. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks a lot.
We'll talk to you soon. Tomorrow's guest will be Serenity Caldwell from iAmore, as well as an interview with Kurt Wagner from Recode, with a recap of everything that happens at tomorrow morning's F8 Developer Conference keynote, and I'm assuming some of the kind of later breaking developments throughout the day. TNT records live every Monday through Friday at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, 12 a.m. UTC at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show always by emailing us. That's tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a short voicemail. It's 260-TNT-SHOW, and you can find us on Twitter. We're at TechNewsTodayTV.
And get our show first if you can't watch live by subscribing at twit.tv/TNT. And get our newsletter at twit.tv/newsletter. And you can find me on Twitter. I am at Meg Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to our technical director, Anthony Nielsen, and all the folks who help us produce this show every single day. Thanks to you for talking tech with us today. We'll see y'all tomorrow. Bye.